The Word of Mouth podcast from NHPR is made possible with support from you, our subscribers.
And from Heinemann, a provider of resources written by real teachers for real classrooms. Heinemann values teachers as decision makers and students as curious learners. Discover the path to lifelong professional learning at Heinemann.com. Heinemann, dedicated to teachers.
And he swings and rips one deep to right down the line toward the corner, hooking, and it's a home run. A two-run homer for the Bronx Star.
This is Word of Mouth.
Your questions answered, your state explored.
Producer Justine Paradise.
Jimmy Gutierrez.
Justine, what do you know about baseball?
And the cycle for Brock Holt. He hits for the cycle in a postseason game.
Well, my dad likes baseball.
All right. Yeah. Do you have any interest whatsoever?
I mean, I wouldn't say I have a strong disinterest. Well, I watched when the Red Sox won for the first time when they broke the curse.
Okay, 0-4.
Back to Folk. Red Sox fans have longed to hear it. The Boston Red Sox are world champions.
And then I think that's basically what I got.
That's quite a bit more, I think. Like, and the reason I'm asking these questions is because a lot of people, including like the majority of this station's demographic, don't really care to follow or follow sports.
Don't paint public radio people with one brush over here. Come on.
That's what I'm doing. I painted them all. But I mean, so what is this? This leads to us not really covering sports. But I think there's a lot of relevant stuff to dig into. And the age of kind of activist athletes and shut up and dribble, we're going to spend some time looking into the role that sports play in shaping culture. And to bring it back to baseball, the baseball diamond was one of the earliest sites of racial integration.
So the diamond, the field that baseball's played on.
Look at how fast you're catching.
Oh my God.
Yeah. So can you believe that integrating wasn't a smooth process?
Hard to believe, yeah.
Mm. The game had an incredibly difficult time integrating black players into their ranks. And there are consequences even today because that history is still not fully understood or addressed.
Just keep the racist stuff out of there. I heard the N-word and...
Would you say you hear more of it in Boston than other cities, Adam?
I'm not going to say nitpick and just say, you know, here's bad, but there's a long history of these kind of incidents in Boston. And, you know, I've spoke with various players of different eras, and a lot of the things that they've told me I can't say.
This is Adam Jones, one of the few black major league players, speaking after a game at Fenway Park in Boston last year. He said fans were yelling racist taunts and even threw a bag of peanuts at him. But what if I told you that things weren't always this way?
Like, what do you mean? Like, there was a time when baseball was actually more inclusive of people of color?
Exactly. And what if I told you that the integration of pro baseball in the U.S. in the 20th century, the original laboratory, happened right here in Nashua, New Hampshire.
The original laboratory. I don't know. I would need to hear more.
So we are right now in Holman Stadium. They just celebrated their 80th birthday. And let's walk on in. This is kind of like hallowed ground
here,
right?
Absolutely, yeah. Every time I come through these gates here, I think about, you know, the people that came in here before me. You know, the fans that are generations before my time saw a different kind of baseball here.
Oh, who's this?
My name is Steve Daly, a longtime sports writer here in Nashua, New Hampshire.
Steve is the author of Dem Little Bums, a book that tells the history of the Nashua Dodgers. That's the team that integrated pro ball in 1946.
1946, so that's 70 years ago, right?
Yeah, 70 years ago. I don't know why, but that feels a lot longer. Check this out. In 1946, the average cost of a new house, under $6,000. It was the same year the microwave was invented. And this iconic Christmas song was brand new.
Oh, the weather outside is frightful, but the fire is so delightful. And since we've no place to go.
Okay, enough of that.
Classic.
1946 was also the year before Jackie Robinson would make his major league debut.
All right, Jackie Robinson, I know that name.
Yeah, Jackie Robinson obviously is rightly contributed or rightly credited with the integration of baseball, being that first player to cross that color barrier. But at the same time that he was playing in Montreal, Don Newcomb and Roy Campanella were playing here in Nashua, New Hampshire.
Both of these guys were exemplary examples of the talent that was there in the Negro Leagues. I'm Bob Kendrick, president, Negro Leagues Baseball Museum, Kansas City, Missouri.
At the time, Newcomb was a 19-year-old pitching sensation who could also hit, and 24-year-old Campanella had already been catching professionally for 9 years. He actually thought he was heading to Nashville, considering he had never heard of Nashua before.
You didn't see very many catchers and pitchers leave the Negro Leagues to get to the major leagues. Again, you have to remember those were positions that both were thought to be cerebral positions. And so that prevailing mindset was that the players in the Negro Leagues weren't smart enough to play those positions.
Brooklyn Dodgers president at the time, Branch Rickey, wasn't just a brilliant baseball mind. He was a savvy business person. He knew with the best players, black or white, people would come out and pay to watch his Dodgers play.
Branch Rickey may have had 6 or 7 black players before half the major leagues had even integrated.
Jackie Robinson spent that first season in Montreal. As for Campanella and Newcomb, the organization was still searching for a home. They set their sights on a league in the Midwest. The 3i League had teams in Illinois, Indiana, and Iowa.
But the commissioner of that league threatened to shut the league down if they decided to put Campanella and Newcomb on the team that the Dodgers had in that league.
The commissioner threatened to shut down the entire league. The Dodgers pivoted. They looked into starting a team with the New England League, a 14-team league made up of northeastern mill towns and the equivalent of double-A ball.
The organization absolutely did its homework coming in here. They did, you know, clearly because of this huge social experiment that they were having, they wanted to make sure that it was going to work.
Dodgers brass looked for a town with a racially progressive newspaper. They also looked for a large French-Canadian population, believing they were less hostile towards African-Americans. Finally, the organization settled on Nashua and Holman Stadium. Back in 1946, Nashua's population was around 34,000 people, with less than 50 black residents. While they were easily the smallest city in the league, with Don Newcomb and Roy Campanella, they were stacked with talent.
From the start, you could tell that there was something special about this 1946 Nashua team. Campanella, almost from the very beginning, was, not only provided the talent that this team need, but he provided that leadership behind the plate.
The team started slow, but turned things on when it mattered most.
You know, they probably could have finished first, but they knew that the top two teams are going to make the playoffs. And they figured, if we finish second, we'll just turn it on when we have to. And they did.
The inaugural season of the Nashua Dodgers ended with a championship. Roy Campanella was named the league's MVP. Don Newcomb, still a teenager, was dominant. And this was the first of 3 titles the Nashua Dodgers would win consecutively. In 1949, as Roy Campanella and Don Newcomb were now playing in Brooklyn in the majors, things in the city of Nashua were changing drastically.
A lot of these factories closed shop and moved south, and with that was a tremendous blow to the economy in this area because it just put so many people out of work. You know, when you are out of work and your income is limited, pretty much the last thing you're going to be able to spend that limited income on is a baseball game. At some point during the 1949 season, they realized we're not coming back.
The other cities that made up the New England League were also hit hard. Places like Portland, Maine, Lynn, Massachusetts, even Manchester. 1949 wasn't just the last season for the Nashua Dodgers. It was the last season for the entire league.
See, Nashua, to me, is more than just a footnote in history as those two pioneers come through and break color barrier there on their way to what I think, again, both should be Hall of Fame careers.
Don Newcomb went on to play 10 years of Major League ball. He was the first pitcher to win Rookie of the Year, the MVP award, and the Cy Young award. He even missed 2 years in his prime to serve in the Korean War. And for Roy Campanella, aside from being a product endorser and celebrity, he was a 3-time MVP, 8-time All-Star, and in 1969, he was voted into baseball's Hall of Fame.
And certainly going to be on everybody's top 100 greatest players of all time, major league players of all time. And who knows, had it not been for the car accident. just what kind of numbers Campy would have put up.
In 1958, driving to his home on a January night, Campanella hit a patch of ice, lost control of his car, and crashed. He was paralyzed from the shoulders down. He'd go on to regain use of his hands and arms, but would remain in a wheelchair for the rest of his life. But for Campanella and Newcomb, their legacy was never just baseball.
One of the most important lessons about revisiting the era of integration is understanding it as a process.
Adrian Burgos is a history professor at the University of Illinois and editor of LaVidaBaseball.com. It would take another 12 years for every major league team to integrate at least one black player onto their team. But Burgos says the playing field was never really level. Players of color weren't allowed to make mistakes or get injured without threat of losing their spot. Spanish-speaking players were told to speak English only even if they couldn't. And all players of color had to be considerably better than their white counterparts even for the chance to play.
And it raises the whole question about what is integration? Is it just acquiring the talent on the field, or is it about transforming the game, truly bringing in, integrating the people, the culture, and their lives?
It's worth noting here exactly how radical it was to bring Roy Campanella and Don Newcomb to Nashua in 1946, or Jackie Robinson playing in the majors 1 year later.
Jackie's breaking of baseball's color barrier wasn't just a part of the civil rights movement. It was actually the beginning of the civil rights movement. Because again, you think about this, this is 1947. President Truman would not integrate the military until a year after Jackie.
Even Congress had yet to integrate, and Brown v. Board of Education was still years away.
So for all intents and purposes, this is what started the ball of social progress rolling in our country, baseball. And our country literally jumped on the coattail of baseball. And so even though Major League Baseball had been vilified for not allowing blacks to play, when it opened its door, our country followed suit.
Few people know that when Jackie Robinson got to the majors, he was already 28 years old. Half of his career as a ball player was already over. Bob Kendrick says he was far from the best player in the Negro Leagues, but he was the right player to be the first. Robinson was worldly, educated, and coming from Los Angeles, he wasn't accustomed to Jim Crow. More importantly, he was the right man to pave the way for players like Roy Campanella and Don Newcomb.
Baseball, at its crux, is a game of failure. You fail more times than you succeed in this sport, and really, they can't fail. They cannot fail, which is why it was so important for Branch Rickey to find the right guy.
Back in Nashua, you can follow Don Newcomb Way or Campanella Way right to the gates of Holman Stadium. Before entering the concourse, fans are greeted by two 12-foot banners of each player. Inside, Holman seats just under 3,000 people. Instead of outfield seating, there's a backdrop of 80-year-old New Hampshire pines. And if you look down the left field line to the brick wall, you'll see the numbers 39 and 36. 39 for Campanella and 36 for Newcomb. One more time, here's local sports writer Steve Daly.
You close your eyes and you kind of envision them playing here. And there has been a lot of baseball played here since then, and there will be a lot of baseball played after that, after now. But you'll never be able to take away that piece of history that Nashua has, that claim to fame that Roy Campanella and Don Newcomb started their trip to the major league here at Holman Stadium.
Who'd have thought we'd have this kind of history in Nashua?
Yeah, right? I was very surprised, like, over and over again, just reporting on it.
That's super cool. Yeah, the fact that baseball was, like Bob Kendrick said, that baseball's integration was kind of the start of the civil rights movement.
And he told me that it was the courage that those players had to change the country to something that we could be proud of. But speaking of being proud, I think it's time that we dig into our local baseball team.
Why do I have a bad feeling about this?
Yeah, so if we're looking into the history of baseball's integration, we've got to talk about the Boston Red Sox. So the Red Sox were the last team to integrate. It took them another 12 years after Brooklyn did. They even tried out Jackie Robinson, They had a shot at signing Roy Campanella, Don Newcomb, Willie Mays, almost every player of color back in the day. They didn't.
They all lost out.
Yeah, I mean, that curse of 04, I mean, that was really self-inflicted. They also didn't sign a black free agent for another 30-plus years. They've had multiple lawsuits filed against them for deliberately barring black players.
But, I mean, that sounds like they kind of shot themselves in the foot. Like, they lost out on some really good players.
Right, and also changing the culture. And I think this gives context to why Boston, as a sports town, gets such a bad rap amongst athletes. So I gave Howard Bryant a call. He's an author and senior writer for ESPN The Magazine. He grew up in Boston, and his first book was called Shutout, a story of race and baseball in Boston. I asked him, as someone who had grown up in the city, with the history of the Red Sox, did he grow up as a fan of the team?
Well, I think it was more generational for us. I mean, when we were kids in the mid-1970s, the Red Sox were a great team. I remember when the Red Sox in 75 obviously played in what's often considered to be the greatest World Series of all time against Cincinnati. All the kids were Red Sox fans. There's no doubt about that. I remember, and we grew up in Dorchester and in, you know, the all-black side of Dorchester, because, of course, Dorchester was pretty much segregated part of town. And all of the kids at the time rooted for, you know, Jim Rice and Yaz and Bill Lee and Bernie Carbo and the rest of them. But at the same time, there were two things that were taking place. The first thing that was taking place was that none of us had ever gone to a game, even though Fenway Park wasn't that far from us. Fenway Park was a subway ride. And the second thing that was happening is that the adults, none of them rooted for the Red Sox at all. They were all Cardinals fans. They were Dodgers fans. They were all National League fans. And, of course, as I got older, I understood why. And it was because the National League had integrated. The Red Sox didn't integrate. The American League integrated later. And those wounds carried over into the generation. Obviously, as little kids, we didn't make that distinction, but the grown-ups did, and that probably explained why none of them took us to games, and probably also price and affordability was part of it, too.
You're going over, like, growing up with that team. That was a pretty great team. And you had Jim Rice to grow up with. But you actually say that your favorite player was Dave Winfield.
Yeah, and that's as you get older. And that was sort of the interesting thing. When I was really little, I was a Red Sox fan. And then as I got older into the 80s, when I started to get into high school and middle school and everything like that, then you started to realize there were certain identity issues that were important to you. And the black players in the Red Sox just all seemed really unhappy. Oil Can Boyd was miserable in Boston. Jim Rice never seemed particularly happy in Boston. None of the players, the players that I really identified with, really showed a great joy of being in the city or love of the sport in a lot of ways. And I gravitated toward the team's greatest enemies, which were the Yankees, in terms of, I remember specifically when I realized how much I enjoyed watching Winfield, and it was watching him walk to the plate. I remember it was 81, his first year with the Yankees, and I would watch him go up to the plate and stride, head up, confident, ready to play. And that was a guy you wanted to be. That was a guy who was taking on the world in a way that sort of piqued your imagination as a 13-year-old, instead of just sort of the players in Boston who just were never, they never seemed comfortable. They never seemed like they enjoyed it. Maybe that was also, as we learn later, some of it was just personality based. But then we also find out later, as you know, as I got older, you also sort of recognized that they weren't happy, that they didn't want to be in Boston, that they didn't feel that they were necessarily appreciated in the city. And then you find out, of course, later some of the racial animosities that they went through playing here, and also having to have some appreciation for the fact that they also played during one of the most tumultuous times in the city racially, during the desegregation crisis.
Yeah, we had opened this show with a clip from last year, and that's when, you know, Adam Jones was being racially taunted, had peanuts hurled at him while at Fenway. And in the clip, he actually talks about talking to past generations of players. This is nothing new to people that had spent a lot of time with the Red Sox organization or in Boston. And I don't want to ask you as, like, you know, hey, thank you for coming on, black sports writer from Boston, to speak on, you know, for what is happening in Boston. But at the same time, I have to ask you, like, what is happening in Boston? Like, why is this, like, players from around the league understand that this happens, particularly more here?
That's an interesting question, and it's a question that I'm not even sure is particularly accurate. However, there are some things that are accurate. Number one, what Adam Jones said was that baseball was a white man's sport. And he didn't say Boston was a white man's city for baseball. He said baseball is a white man's sport. He's talking about all 30 teams in all the markets. And he's not wrong about that. And when you look at the numbers statistically, it pretty much shows it. In fact, if you look at the Red Sox makeup today, the Red Sox are one of the most integrated teams in baseball. The Red Sox have more black players than most teams, and that's very, very different and sort of ironic in some ways. But to speak about Boston specifically, I think there are a few reasons. I think, number one, the city has always been shadowed by busing. I think the recent history of Boston, the last 50 years of Boston, undermined the previous 200 years of Boston, where Boston had been a fairly tolerant, decent place for black people to live. If you look at the history of African Americans in the city of Boston, up until, I would say, World War II, the history is much, much different. The history is actually a somewhat triumphant one when you compare it to the rest of the country. If you look at Boston post-war, very, very, very different story. I think the second thing that happened from a sports perspective, too, is the fact that the Red Sox had never signed a black free agent. All those great black players who were available in the free agent era. The Red Sox didn't sign their first black free agent until the winter of 1992. So you had a combination of whether or not the player chose not to come to Boston or the team chose not to sign black free agents. A combination of the two really led to that city's reputation. Because on the one hand, if you sign a black player in free agency, chances are, especially a superstar player, chances are that player is now going to be the face of your franchise. They're going to be the most highest paid player. They're going to be the one who everybody looks toward. So there's that. The Red Sox also have never had a black manager either. I mean, Alex Cora, the team's been around for 117 years, and this is the first year. In the 118th year, they hired their first minority manager. And the problem with all of this is you don't have a balanced black culture. You know, it's not like it's Baltimore where you still have black culture. You get, you know, 55 or 60%, you know, black city, or Detroit, or, you know, Chicago or L.A. where you've got a significant amount of black culture to sort of balance all this, which is why I say it's not necessarily a Boston thing. It's a numbers thing. If Boston had black culture and black successes in other places, if they could actually elect a black mayor or something like that, we wouldn't be talking about the Red Sox the way we are.
Mm-hmm.
But because there's nothing to counterbalance it, the racism of the city and of the radio stations and the rest of
it
all comes forward.
Right. It just permeates kind of everything.
Exactly. It becomes, you know, it becomes the Adam Jones prophecy. It becomes a white city.
You know, if we're picking up this story from 47, with Jackie Robinson on the Dodgers, or even 1959 with Pumpsy Green, you know, the Red Sox being the last team to integrate, there's a stat that kind of shook me. And while Latino representation has risen since 1959, representation of black players has actually dropped in the majors.
Sure it has.
And can you put words to that? Can you make sense of that for us?
It's very simple. It's money. In the 1940s and 1950s, the Negro Leagues were the cheapest source of talent. They were the cheapest, most available source of talent. Willie Mays signed his first contract for $6,000. Hank Aaron signed for $5,000. Hank Aaron signed his first contract for $6,000. Jackie Robinson signed his first contract for, I think, $5,000. And then look at the number of Negro Leaguers who just flooded the major leagues. That infrastructure now has been sent over to the Dominican Republic. That's where you can, if you take $100,000, you can get many more players through the Dominican in terms of developing and controlling them and keeping them in your organization than you can in the United States because of the draft. There's no incentive for Major League Baseball clubs to develop American players because what's the point of developing an American player so he can be drafted by one of your rivals? So now you go to colleges to draft players. And Major League Baseball, I'm sorry, in college, you know, the NCAA, it's, I think, college baseball is 2% black because baseball is not a revenue sport in college. the black players at universities are playing basketball and football. This is an economic story. And so you've got an infrastructure issue that nobody really, really wants to tackle. And they, instead, they say that the black player doesn't want to play the game, which is nonsense, and it's insulting. You know, if you look for players, you're going to find them. Where is baseball looking for players? Overseas and college. They're not looking where they used to look.
That was Howard Bryant, author and senior writer for ESPN the magazine. His most recent book is titled The Heritage: Black Athletes, A Divided America, and the Politics of Patriotism. And that's it for today's show. A special thank you to Nick Caggiano, Ray Doswell, and Gaspar Gonzalez for his doc, A Long Way Home: The Untold Story of Baseball's Desegregation. Today's show was produced by Justine Paradise and me, Jimmy Gutierrez. Our team includes Taylor Quimby, Hannah McCarthy, and Jackie Hubbard. Erica Janik is our executive producer. Maureen McMurray is the director of Ghosting and Ghosts of All Kinds. Music in today's show was provided by Blue Dot Sessions and Young Carts. Word of Mouth is a production of NHPR. Stay tuned for an episode of Outside In after a short break.